Stunned silence.
What is this?
We're doing a little bit of a
show. So it must be doing something, right?
And it's playing,
Tell us what you mean.
I just can't think of it.
I love the enthusiasm. You're tuned to the 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 128 for June 2018. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios tonight, we welcome back Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. Nice to talk to you again.
Mate, always a pleasure to talk to you, and always
birthday
a pleasure.
Month.
It is. Yeah, thank you for remembering. Always a pleasure to talk to the lovely Anna. How are you, Anna?
I'm well, thank you, James. Good to be back.
Yes, great to have you both. How are you both? It's a bit, we're into winter now, I'll tell you what. It's definitely feeling it over here. How's it over there in Australia?
Yeah, it's pretty chilly.
Pretty chilly?
Yeah.
It's right. We've had storms, we've had flooding, we've had very cold weather, we've had ice on the windshields, and it's only the very beginning of June, for goodness sake.
It's almost the shortest day of the year, so sometimes you can be like, well, I think it'll be better from here, you know, that's true or not.
One can hope. But everything's going well over there for you guys?
Pretty well, thanks.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Good.
So we'll get another New Zealander back on the show.
Yeah, we should. Actually, that's a good point.
Outnumbered by New Zealanders living in Australia versus New Zealanders living in New Zealand.
On New Zealand's first podcast. That's a good point.
Maybe we should have the voice.
Oh.
Maybe we could have
tryouts.
Chairs.
Spin them around, hit the button.
Oh.
It's a good idea. Good idea. Yeah. You can see where our producers.
I'll line it up.
See where our producer's mind is going, which is good because this first story probably needs us to be having a bit of levity, otherwise it's all downhill from here. This is from Nine News in Australia. South Australian Catholic Archbishop Philip Wilson could face time behind bars after being found guilty of concealing child sex abuse by another priest. The state's highest ranking Catholic Church official appeared shocked as the verdict was delivered in the Newcastle Magistrates Court. Wilson, who's 67, was accused of covering up the abuse of the then 10-year-old altar boy, Peter Krieg, by convicted paedophile priest Jim Fletcher near Newcastle in 1971. It's alleged that Mr. Krieg, is it Krieg or Cray?
Mr. Cray.
It's alleged Mr. Cray told Wilson about the crimes in 1976, but the Archbishop, who was suffering the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, says he has no memory of the conversation. Another of Fletcher's victim, Daniel Feenan, was born in 1976 and said if something had been done that year, his life would have been very different. Speaking to reporters outside court, Mr. Feenan told reporters he was very happy with the verdict. I know there's more than likely going to be appeals and whatnot, but that news today, everyone around the world on face value can see that he is guilty, he said. During his trial, Wilson was accused of being a consummate Catholic politician and a man who was part of an entrenched toxic culture of covering things up. Prosecutors also accused him of lying under oath in court. The way the accused answered questions, Your Honour, would have serious doubts as to his honesty, said Prosecutor Gather Harrison. The accused does in fact remember the crimes but continues to cover it up, he said. This is yet another podcast and another story talking about the worst kind of actions of some of the real blights on the church. What do we make of this, Gavin? Obviously it's something where it's still a developing case, given that he's been found guilty. I guess we can talk about the accused and we'll talk about the facts of the cases that have been presented, not wanting anyone to speak outside of those. But what were your thoughts on the basis of this case?
Yeah, it's a story that's been, I think, hard for people to cover and hard for people to fathom. It's been portrayed as the Archbishop covered up crimes in the 1970s. What he's actually been convicted of, which is a new law in the state of New South Wales where this happened when he was a very junior priest. So as you mentioned there, it said that a young boy who was abused in the early 1970s, several years later, he says that he told Archbishop, or then Father Wilson, about the abuse that he had suffered at the hands of another priest who was later convicted and died in prison. So what this crime actually relates to, that the the Archbishop has been found guilty of is actually that in 2004, 2005, 2006, when the crimes against this priest who was convicted were being examined, that he would have then been Bishop Wilson, I think, or maybe already Archbishop Wilson, because he was a bishop in Wollongong first, that he, having been told about them, as the as is claimed in the 1970s, that he should have, in 2004, 5 and 6, while the investigation was going on, let the authorities know at that point. So it's quite a tricky case in so much as what he did or didn't do, and when he did or didn't do it, and what he did or didn't hear from this then boy back in the 1970s. So it certainly sent shockwaves through the Catholic world, as has been reported in many places. The highest ranking official in the church around the world to have been found guilty of this sort of thing, which is being portrayed by people as concealing or covering up, and I guess I understand that sort of language, but given the complexity of the case, it's sort of hard to try and put your finger on it exactly.
It doesn't sound as cut and dry, I guess, when you give us that context as the story read. I mean, I knew nothing about the case other than what I've seen in this coverage, and that wouldn't have been what I would have assumed on the basis of what you've said there. So that's really interesting to get some extra colour to the facts.
Yeah, so it's so the Archbishop later stood down. He hasn't resigned, but he did stand down, and a few days later, the Holy Father appointed an apostolic administrator to the archdiocese, which is a fairly unusual step, given that the archbishop is still in place. So there's some statutes that allow that to happen. So the archbishop has stood down, and an apostolic administrator, who's actually the bishop of the neighbouring diocese, has been put in place to oversee the leadership and governance of the diocese. So I think the archbishop is due to be sentenced next week. And then I understand the way it works is that after he's sentenced, he'll have the opportunity to make a decision on whether he'll appeal the conviction and or the sentencing at that point. So there will continue to be developments on the story, but a lot of international interest in it around the world, and certainly a very difficult time for all sorts of people, not least the survivors who came and shared their stories.
It's just, and I mean, it's one of these things where, again, it feels like every time we talk about these stories, it's just more tragedy, really, to uncover. Did you have anything else when you sort of heard about the story and some of the details that Gavin's shared with us?
Well, it just shows how, because of their historic nature, like just how complicated they are legally.
Yeah.
Like if you think of, as I was sort of reading about, going through the show notes and things, and I was just thinking, I wonder, there probably is a number of older priests and bishops who are probably feeling pretty uncomfortable at the moment, because perhaps they had some inkling of something way back when, you know, and are wondering if that's ever going to come out. And perhaps it's, you know, coming forward is not, like, because of the complexity of the legalities around it, you know, coming forward is maybe not necessarily an option, depending, because the victim might not want you to come forward or whatever, you know, like there's all those kinds of things. So
I think
it is
the reality is that it's not just church people, right? I mean, these sort of things happen in all sorts of other contexts.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, a lot
absolutely.
Of it sort of rings very, you know, very relevant in the whole, we're living in a post Me Too world. And a lot of the Me Too accusations are coming from historical. And I mean, this is not just so we're clear. I mean, not like, I don't think we need to, you know, clarify or belabor the point with our audience, but just so we're clear, there is no sanctioning of abuse by anyone on this podcast, nor is there sanctioning of any covering up of the abuses. I mean, we're on record as saying, I still stand by it, anyone who is accused should face the full force of the law. But the thing that's, well, not but, full stop. the thing that's difficult in these situations is, as you say, when there's so much time that's passed and when there's so many inherent complexities, is it's not as black and white as some of us may like. And I think because the crimes are so abhorrent, there's this deep sense of injustice and therefore, you know, vengeance that people actually want. You want it to be black and white and go, yes, find the guys and string them up, kind of thing. And I don't know, sometimes it's not as clear cut as that.
And I reckon that there's, you know, if this boy, I mean, many of the victims told lots of people, and their parents, their teacher, whatever, and at a particular time when perhaps not reporting it wasn't a crime.
Yeah.
And so it was still a horrendous thing not to do, and it was not good for the safety of the child and children in obviously later times, like that the other accuser or victim, you know, saying, gosh, if they had uncovered this priest's horrible crimes before, you know, I got to the age where he started abusing me, you know, that would have made my life completely different. And so, you know, the impact of that is horrendous. But yeah, like the whole legal thing surrounding it, and do we go, is a witch hunt appropriate? Like I'm in Wilson's case, like I don't know why he didn't come forward then. If he did have that knowledge, like that would have, you know, in the during the trial of this priest. But there must be loads of people who have heard things about certain people and never done anything about it. And you know, what do you do with all them?
Yeah.
It's interesting because Archbishop Wilson is seen by many people as one of the key drivers of child protection policies in a good sense within the church. So in Wollongong and in Adelaide, so there's a lot of people that sort of say, you know, they struggle to reconcile the person who, when he became a bishop, put in all these, you know, stricter guidelines and policies and that sort of thing, with someone who would have knowingly failed to report all those years ago. Now, clearly people mature and go through different evolutions during the course of their life, but he's certainly held up by many as someone who in Wollongong and in Adelaide has done some really positive things in terms of child protection. So there are so many twists and turns in this case, and I suspect they're not over, as I say, sentencing I think next week. So it's interesting because there is that mentality that, and I'm not suggesting that this has happened to Archbishop Wilson, but that those who are on trial, so at the moment high profile, Archbishop Wilson, who was found guilty, and Cardinal Pell, who's, we think, awaiting trial because now there's a super injunction so that nobody can know anything that's happening around the Cardinal Pell story. You know, that they are the symbols of a church that has failed so dramatically over the past several decades, they are possibly being held to account for the sins of lots and lots of others. And, you know, this is a case that goes back 40 years about a conversation that did or didn't happen.
And I think that that's probably the fundamental point for me, Gavin. I mean, this is it's symptomatic of the fact that the church has, or members of the church and then the church hierarchy have failed so completely and so comprehensively that there is zero trust remaining. Anyone who has even who is even close to being guilty or anything by association or anything else, it's game over. There is so much hurt that has been done, so much harm that has been done by people, that I think this is an inevitability. And as we've said on this podcast, and I'll say it again, this unfortunately will not be the last time we'll be covering these kind of stories, because I honestly think for as long as this podcast is on air, the church will be, and probably after that, you know, on air, I don't know if on air, but you know what I mean, the church will be having to deal with the repercussions of the acts of a small number, but a significant number of people who have made terrible, terrible, abhorrent, committed abhorrent crimes, and will be picking up the pieces for years yet. We'll move on to this story a little bit closer to home in terms of New Zealand. This is from the NZ Catholic. Newly ordained Dunedin Bishop Michael Dooley and Christchurch Bishop Paul Martin joined all the other New Zealand bishops as well as priests and seminarians at a mass commemorating the 118th Founders Day celebration for Holy Cross Seminary. Bishop Martin, who was the main celebrant, said the occasion was not a static reality, as is often perceived, but a reflection of the church's changing needs. Quote, "The fact that we are celebrating Founders Day here in Ponsonby, Auckland, rather than in Mosgiel, Dunedin, reflects the changing needs and situation we find ourselves in and the ability to actually respond to these needs and circumstances," he said. Bishop Martin said Christians have to be courageous and take risks, as following Christ will demand of us constantly to be seen where the Holy Spirit is leading. Quote, "This courage is based on what God is asking of us in the situations in which we find ourselves, situations where we trust that God will be at work. And so while the fundamentals of our faith remain the same, the expressions and places and means of doing so need to be scrutinized and effective to see they are meeting the needs." Scrutinized and effective? Need to be scrutinized, I guess, to see if they are effective, that they are meeting the needs and demands of the age in which we live, he said. Bishop Martin said the gospel is dynamic and proclaimed within a culture. We are called to see where God is at work within the culture so we can evangelize from within rather than without, he said. He said, "Preaching the good news is not always fashionable or popular. People may also look down on us or mock us or ignore us, but this is where we need the courage of the Holy Spirit, the courage mm-hmm. that we have heard of in the gospel promised to us by Christ to envelop us and to help us be the people who love God and love God so much we want everyone to share it despite the reaction we might have seen," he said. So this is some pretty good stuff from the newly ordained Bishop Dooley there, and Bishop Martin coming in and saying some pretty great stuff there as well about the changing realities of the church. It's something where we've talked a little bit in the past on the podcast, Anna, about the changing realities of the way in which the church meets the needs and spreads the good news. I mean, this podcast is a testament to that. The message hasn't changed in 2,000 years, but the way in which the message is delivered probably has. What did you make of the good bishop's comments there?
Well, first of all, what was interesting is that out of all the bishops, I believe, all the current non-retired bishops, he's the only one who wouldn't have gone through Mosgiel. He wouldn't have been Holy Cross Seminary, right?
Oh, because he's a Marist.
Yeah. Anyway, it's
interesting.
Yeah, neither here nor there, but he got to. maybe if it was the 120th. Anniversary celebration, maybe he wouldn't have got the job as main celebrant, but anyway,
inside baseball,
inside,
yeah.
Inside.
Yeah. Look, I think that these are the difficulties of our time, isn't it? Like, always trying to share the gospel and share the gospel in a way that people will be able to catch hold and receive it, and also for it to become the good news for them. So it's good to have those words of encouragement and encouragement to be courageous and to seek what God is perhaps calling us to do in this moment and this now, and be open to the Holy Spirit leading us and guiding us, and particularly those who are going through the Holy Cross Seminary, right?
Indeed.
So
I thought it was interesting that the two newbies, I don't know if that, Anna, you've probably been to a Founders Day or two, whether it's traditional that the younger bishops provide these sorts of exhortations, or whether it's just geographical thing that it sort of rotates around the country, and it was their turn or whatever. But I just was interested that both been ordained for less than what, 3 or 4 months, and were the ones who were quoted. So,
what did you think of the comments in general, Gavin? You think that he's on point in what he's saying, or do you think he's off base?
Oh, he's clearly off base. No, I think it was good. I think there is a reality when you're speaking to young men who are not all young men these days either, for that matter, but those who are seeking to become priests. There is a reality that you do need a bit of courage these days, even, you know, and again, you sort of think about some of our brothers and sisters overseas, what, you know, courage really looks like when it comes to practicing the faith.
Mm.
You know, walking past, walking to church and wondering if there might be some sort of terrorist who wants to attack you. Now, it's not the issue in New Zealand, Australia, or the US, or some of the Western countries, but there is a different kind of courage that's required to speak proudly and boldly about your faith in some of those countries like Australia and New Zealand. So
someone's
give priests that.
Sorry, I was just going to say, sorry, someone's phone's a little bit close to the microphone and keeps buzzing. So just it's underscoring your point, but maybe talking over the top of it as well. Yeah. No, I think
you need to be courageous and speak into society proudly, but mindful of the culture in which we're living these days.
But I think also mindful of that, the global culture, right? Because the reality is that, exactly as you say, some of their brothers, some of the others in our faith do not have the luxuries we have and the first world problems that we have. So the call for courage, even if they ever need any inspiration, they don't have to look very far to sort of see what some people have to go through for their faith.
Mm.
I do like the fact that it's talking about how did he phrase it? How do you find that while the fundamentals of our faith remain the same, the expressions and places and means of doing so need to be scrutinized? So that's that thing where, again, I know we're a little bit biased given that we're sitting on a podcast talking about the faith, but it is that concept of we don't want the faith itself to change because, you know, I think Christ kind of got that stuff right. But how we as a church find ways to communicate that and understand that and help others to understand it, build up a fire and a passion. That's the thing which we need to be constantly thinking about in terms of the evolution of the message of the faith. Good stuff from the new bishops. Speaking of courage, this is from the Associated Press. The Vatican called on Friday for courageous proposals to come with a shortage of priests in the Amazon and said it wouldn't rule out debate on whether married men could step in to fill the precariously thin presence of the Catholic Church in the vast region. In a preparatory document seeking input from South American bishops for the Vatican's 2019 meeting on the Amazon, organisers also said the church must identify new official ministries for women to play in the region. The call was not a suggestion that women could be ordained priests, which Catholic doctrine forbids and Pope Francis has reaffirmed, but it leaves open the door to making official some ministries that women in remote parts of Latin America already perform, including celebrating baptisms. And it calls for new ways to increase access to the Eucharist in a part of the world where the Church counts around one priest for every 10,000 Catholics and where remote communities can go weeks or months at a time before a priest arrives to celebrate Mass. The call for courageous, daring, and fearless proposals suggests that the Vatican wants the region's bishops to put forward concrete proposals on whether married men of proven virtue, so-called viri probati, would celebrate Mass in places where priests are in short supply. The viri probati proposal has been around for decades, but has drawn fresh attention under history's first Latin American pope, thanks to his familiarity with the challenges facing the Amazon church. This is some fascinating stuff, Gavin. I always find stories that talk about how hard it is for Catholics around the world to go to Mass, and then I feel a little bit guilty about how I sometimes struggle when I think about maybe going to daily Mass or something, and I'm like, it is down the road at 9 o'clock, and that would mean moving meetings around and stuff like that. We can't really complain at 1 to 10,000 Catholics, I think. I think our ratio is probably a bit better than that. But what do you make of this viri probati, if I'm butchering the Latin, proposal?
I think that's pretty good. That's pretty good Latin.
Thanks.
It's, there was a, I think, Bishop Dennis Brown, formerly of Hamilton, raised this issue at a synod of bishops many years ago. On behalf of his brother bishops around the Pacific, Papua New Guinea, I think, was the country in particular, where they, I suspect, not in the same, to the same scale, because Papua New Guinea is not quite as large as the Amazon, but they have these similar type of issues. So, as the story suggests, it's not a new thought.
Has it ever been put into effect, though?
I don't believe it has. And I suspect this might we might get as close as we have in the past. I think it's a new phenomenon, sort of. I don't know if it's a post-Vatican II concept. Anna may know better than I, but yeah, I think the nature of priest shortages is really a phenomenon of the last 40 years, to one extent or another, in recent history anyway. So it is a new concept, but I think I struggle to make a strong case against it when you think about people who go months on end without the without access to mass. But I can certainly see the argument for retaining the various structures around the priesthood as being of value and importance. So having not been in a situation where I go, well, at least not for lack of a priest, where I go long stretches without going to mass, that how I would respond to that, and I would certainly probably be someone who'd be advocating for someone who can come and help me access the sacraments.
Yeah. Anna, what do you make of this? Obviously, it's quite a nuanced and complex proposal in terms of the very probati thing, but there's some harsh realities there in terms of the raw statistics.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they obviously, and this is what the Pope is hoping for, you know, is to find some solutions for that area. And I think if they do bring in something like sort of married men being able to, certain men being able to celebrate mass, then that, like, I just kind of think I can see perhaps other areas that are a little bit more liberal in their approach and who don't, like, don't share the same kind of priest shortage as, you know, places like the Amazon. You know, saying, oh, they're doing it, why can't we?
Yeah.
And because that's certainly happened in other sort of different scenarios. So whatever was put in place would have to be, and to be fair, like, the church has done that with missionary countries. You know, there's you know, in certain places throughout the history that perhaps the church is still very young, and there are limitations on, you know, to do with various church structures and things like that, that perhaps they have a period of time where certain things are foregone, you know, because they're impossible to maintain or whatever. And so, you know, having a substitute priests of some kind, you know, might be the way forward, but it would always have to be understood that it was a temporary thing. And I would also argue that there would need to be a move to, like, an ongoing thing to rectify that situation. So, for instance, the Amazon, they need more priests. So why, you know, like, perhaps the church needs to start promoting particular vocations to that area, religious orders that might, you know, that's what religious orders do, right? Many of them are as missionary. So they go to the outer corners of the earth and, you know, to evangelize and to build the church there. And, you know, that there are things like that happening as well.
As well as, yeah.
Perhaps,
Not just dealing with the symptom, like, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Because I think the slippery slope and unintended consequences argument is a really important one, because I think that there's oftentimes, you know, when I think about the one that comes to mind for me is Rite 3 reconciliation, which as I understand it is only designed, how do they phrase it, it's like when you're in grave danger, or, like, you know, it's designed for those who aren't familiar with it. I think the Rite 3 of reconciliation is where you make a confession of the heart, or there's some phrase for it. And it's designed so, you know, a plane is going down and a priest who's on the plane can stand up and basically give everyone mass absolution for their sins. But I've seen a number of parishes locally using Rite 3 reconciliation because it's less confronting than having to sort of sit down with a priest and actually fess up to your sins. And it's things like that where you go, well, it's been allowed in special circumstances with really strict rules, and people have still used it as license to say, well, we'll just interpret those rules as it suits us. So you can sort of see a slippery slope being a bit of a challenge there.
Yeah, and the right three has been a thing in remote parts of Australia as well.
Right.
About whether that should be allowed or not, and certainly the Vatican has made it clear what they think, and some bishops have thought otherwise.
Speaking of the Vatican making it clear and some bishops thinking otherwise, this is from the Associated Press. Pope Francis has told German bishops they can't publish guidelines on whether non-Catholic spouses may receive communion, saying the issue concerns the broader Catholic Church and is too important to be dealt with at the local level. Excuse me. The decision appeared in a letter from the Vatican's Doctrine Office that was published by the L'Espresso blog and was confirmed in a report on the Vatican's news portal. A two-thirds majority of the German Bishops' Conference adopted a proposal in February to allow Protestant spouses of Catholics to receive communion under certain circumstances. The Bishops' Conference approved it as part of a gesture of ecumenical outreach to Protestants in a country where mixed-faith marriages are common. Seven German bishops wrote the Vatican to request a ruling on whether the guidelines violated church doctrine. The Vatican initially declined to rule and asked the German bishops to find a unanimous agreement. But the Doctrine Office letter dated May 25th made clear the Vatican doesn't want the Germans to proceed and intends to study the issue further itself. Cardinal Reinhard Marx, head of the German Bishops' Conference, said he was surprised by the letter given the Vatican's previous request for dialogue. Marx said in a statement issued by a spokesman he still sees further need for discussion within the Bishops' Conference, as well as the Vatican and the Pope. Very interesting stuff, this one here, Anna, and I think if we're talking about what we were just saying in the last one about slippery slope, it's interesting to think that this is something that's on the agenda. I can imagine certain parts of the church rejoicing and other parts of the church being less than pleased. What do you think?
Yeah, look, I would be very hesitant in going down that path. And I'm glad that the Vatican is also being just as cautious. I think, you know, this is something that it's a universal thing. So you can't just have German bishops going, this is what we're going to do in our country. Because as you say, like there's a slippery slope and there's so it's actually something that will impact the entire church community. Plus, you know, they're saying that they're doing it for ecumenical relations and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I reckon that there would be some of our brothers and sisters in Christ who would find that a horrific thing for us to do. It's not necessarily something that non-Catholic churches are going to appreciate, even if individual people within those churches are happy with it or whatever. I think, again, like there needs a lot more consultation with other churches if that's going to happen. And then you'd have to actually change canon law probably to allow that to happen. So it's not something straightforward, you know?
It's interesting, the just, you know, when I was reading through some of the other stories related to it, I was trying to figure out what the special circumstances were, Gavin. And the special circumstances were that a Protestant spouse of a Catholic must receive Holy Communion, may receive Holy Communion after making a, quote, serious examination of conscience with a priest or other person with pastoral responsibilities. They must also affirm the faith of the Catholic Church and wish to end, quote, serious spiritual distress and a, quote, longing to satisfy hunger for the Eucharist. So the thing I'm a bit confused about that is, if a Protestant is affirming the faith of the Catholic Church and has a longing to satisfy hunger for the Eucharist, wouldn't that make them somewhat Catholic? Becoming a Catholic would be the answer?
Yeah. It's, what I was going to say. It seems like a poor idea. It's probably the charitable way of saying what I was planning to say. And the bishops would go down this path. It's interesting just reflecting on this whole idea of local exceptions to universal practice, if that makes any sense. because part of the work of the Royal Commission here in Australia addressed a couple of such areas, so including around celibacy, and I think we've spoken before about the possibly tenuous relationship between celibacy and paedophilia, and given that most paedophilia happens as caused by or committed by people who aren't celibate or aren't invited to be celibate, and the other was around confession. So the Royal Commission suggested that the Church in Australia ought to open those conversations up with the Vatican. As the bishops have said here, well, those are matters for universal practice of the Church, as is communion and who receives it. So therefore, it's not sort of just like, we in Australia, we're going to sort of say celibacy's off in Australia. And the Church in Australia can just make that decision unilaterally.
There was
so clearly not.
Yeah, there was an article I found here that had reference from His Eminence Cardinal Marx, referring to Canon Law 844. Canon 844 says, if the danger of death is present, or if in the judgment of the diocesan bishop or conference of bishops some other grave necessity urges it, Catholic ministers administer these same sacraments licitly also to other Christians not having full communion with the Catholic Church, who cannot approach a minister of their own community and who seek such on their own accord, provided they manifest Catholic faith in respect to these sacraments and are properly disposed. Cardinal Marx also said the document did not specifically call for the Protestant receiving communion to convert to Catholicism, adding that much is left to the local bishop's discretion. Maybe a little bit too much is left to the local bishop's discretion.
Grave necessity.
Yeah, the fear that if the danger of death is present, well, that would be, you know, life. So if you're alive, or if the judgment of the diocesan bishop, like some other grave necessity urges it. Interesting, very interesting. These little this tangled web we weave. You know what we need?
I remember. Oh,
no, you go. No, on you go.
I was just going to say. So
I need to remember.
I was going to say that some of my extended family members are from the Anglican community, and I remember when I was a child, my grandfather, not necessarily, I don't think he was asking himself, but perhaps my mother trying to see whether he could receive communion, him and my grandmother could receive communion, that perhaps were coming to mass for something. It would have been like mum and dad's wedding anniversary, or I don't know,
right,
like they were coming along for something. So they were quite high Anglicans, and they have their own sort of particular form of the Eucharist. I think our parish priest at the time said, sure, why not? Because he basically believes in it. And I'm just, I remember as a child going, oh, that seems quite easy. But he didn't. If my memory serves me correctly, I think they just came and they didn't receive communion. But it's kind of funny having this sort of like looking at this particular example. And you know, I think, you know, there are differences between us, and that's okay. Like, I mean, one day we will be one, and please God, you know, it will happen. Not in a way that is arbitrary or just token. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting what you said, Hannah, about, you know, that other churches might not find this all that palatable. Because if you're like, well, because... You know, because obviously husbands and wives often like to worship together. So it'll be like, well, the spouse in this case, if I can get communion here, why would I bother going to my own church? Now, obviously, there are different understandings of what communion's about and that sort of thing, but it might be seen as, well, I can fully participate in this Catholic Mass, even though I'm not a Catholic. So therefore, why do I need to go to my Lutheran or whatever, Calvinist church to get my spiritual nourishment if they're going to give me communion here even though I'm not a Catholic. So
yeah.
Lots of different tangents one can go off on.
There are different
tangents. But let's not.
No, well, let's though. Here, how about this for a different tangent? From the Catholic News Agency, among the contestants on season 10 of NBC's American Ninja Warrior, there's one who stands out. In addition to being a physical trainer, Father Stephen Gadbury is also a Catholic priest. He hopes that his participation in the upcoming season of American Ninja Warrior will make the clergy appear more human and available. Physical activity can be, quote, a simple way to start a conversation with a spiritual leader, with a pastor, where people may be too nervous or too hesitant to start deeper conversations right off the bat, he told Catholic News Agency. Contestants on the hit NBC show compete in obstacle courses of increasing difficulty, testing their strength, agility, and skill for a shot at $1 million and the title of American Ninja Warrior. The final round takes place on the Las Vegas Strip, where participants must complete, among other obstacles, a 75-foot rope climb in under 30 seconds. Father Gadbury was challenged to apply for the show by Sean Bryan, a two-time previous contestant who drew attention for donning a shirt bearing the colours of the papal flag and the words, Papal Ninja. This is awesome. So I saw it on Facebook. I saw the photo. It's one of these things where friend of the show, Father Roderick Von Hogan, of course, is someone who I think embodies aspects of this, not just because he's a very fit individual running and jogging and doing all those marathons and stuff, but also because it's about taking, being in the world, not of the world, but in the world. I believe one of the, I think it might be St. Paul. And I'd take something like this and go, this is awesome. Mainly because American Ninja Warrior is amazing. Like, if you ever watched that show, it's incredible what they do. This is the kind of thing which gets people talking. It's got to be a good thing, right? As long as it doesn't interfere with his priestly duties, it's got to be a good thing.
Yeah, what makes me think of the... so remember there was an Italian sister who was on, I think, their version of The Voice. Or, you know, Italian Idol or whatever. And in Australia, there was a young priest, Father Rob D'Elia, who was on The Voice. And I think he got through to the second stage, but then he had to pull out because of other commitments. I think those things are pretty cool, all right? Like you do, James.
Yeah. Yeah, you won't see me running the course of American Ninja Warrior, though. Anna, you could be American Ninja Warrior, I reckon. 75-foot rope climb in under 30 seconds?
maybe that's not in the realm of possibility for me. I think it helps if you're really short in Ninja Warrior. Like, if you're short and...
got, like, a low center of gravity?
And power to weight ratio is a bit better. I'm too tall and lanky and it just wouldn't work.
I would go with
that. Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah, because that's my problem. All I'm going with is that I'm just tall and lanky. It's got nothing to do with my total lack of upper body strength and commitment and fitness. But good on the good father, and I hope he wins, because to have a Father American Ninja Warrior would be pretty darn awesome. If you want to listen to more pretty darn awesome stuff, you can go check out previous episodes of this this wonderful podcast. You might even find in listening that it might help you with training if you want to become American Ninja Warrior yourself. No promises, but go back and check through. You have to listen to all the episodes to find the secret. You can find them at www.station15.co.nz, or you can search for us on iTunes or Google Play, or where all good podcasts are found. Just look for The 15th Station, 15th. If you'd like to reach out to us, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email to podcast@station15.co.nz, or you can reach us at twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15. Thank you so much, guys. Anna, always good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me back.
Oh, my pleasure. And Gavin, always a pleasure, mate. Rug up warm over there in the cold in Canberra.
Will do. Enjoy your birthday over this month.
Oh, thanks very much. Thank you, and thank you all out there for listening. If you're in our hemisphere, hope you're warm and cozy. If you're on the other hemisphere, well, we're totally jealous of the sunshine and the warmth. Until next time, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.